Powered by volunteer community involvement, this is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
To Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning, and listener discretion is advised, etc. Also, spoilers ahead. Today I'm joined again by Jill Greening. Hi Jill, thank you so much for being on the show again.
Hi, Olivia. Thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to be here, as always.
Jill Greening is a dance artist and writer who holds a master's in theater and performance studies from York University. They performed across Canada, specifically in Toronto, Vancouver, and Winnipeg, and their writing has been published by The Dance Current, the Journal of Curatorial Studies, and Dance International. They're curious about embodiment and like to explore methods of mark-making, scoring, and sensory-oriented documentation. And before we get started, I just wanted to make a little personal announcement. So I am the new programming coordinator at Cinematheque here in Winnipeg. I'm so excited. It's like a dream come true. And I'll be programming a few film series and hosting monthly live Bikini Drive-In shows on Facebook. And hopefully one day doing like outdoor screenings and stuff like that. So just stay tuned for post-screening discussions and Q&As and so much fun stuff.
Yay, Olivia! I'm so freaking excited.
Yeah,
it's so exciting.
Very stoked.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so just follow Cinematheque on Instagram and on their Facebook pages for any sort of announcements about that. All right, so today we are discussing Nobuhiko Obayashi's 1977 film, House.
House.
Sito, I didn't save you.
I see in your eyes where tomorrow is hiding.
Schoolgirl takes her six classmates to her aunt's country house. There, they come face to face with evil spirits, a house cat, and a haunted piano. So it was Jill's birthday month. Just this past month. So I let them pick the movies. Jill, what is your history with House and why did you choose this movie?
Yeah, thanks for letting me choose. Lately, this is like honestly such a nice birthday present. Especially on COVID, where birthday presents often revolve around delivered food and drink. Yeah. So it's just like
that's
such
always
a nice,
welcome. That's always,
always welcome. Yes. No complaints about that, but this is such a delay. Like, oh my gosh. Also second lockdown birthday. That's
woo.
Yeah, entering 30s being like, yay. Like it's very strange. But whatever. Ugh. It's It's fine. Honestly, yes. Having to like, having the chance to like choose this film, a film that I love and a film that I've never, I just like love it. It's like, ugh, it's so weird. But having the chance to actually delve into like what the kind of bones of it are is like, honestly, it's such a gift and a treat. So thank you. My partner introduced me to this film, I think about 10 years ago. Yeah, officially in my early 20s when I saw it. And we were on a kick of watching other like Japanese works that are kind of like, yeah, weird or bizarre. So I guess it started with like Tampopo. Well, we were had a phase of making fancy ramen. Recipe corner, boop, 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 bikini drive and recipe corner. It was just like, we'd get like ramen noodles, like powder noodles in their little squares. And then adding like a soft boiled egg and nori and aioki mushrooms and tofu. And like, yeah, stuff like that. We were very broke. Anyway, so we'd call this soup tampopo. And I like still crave it so often. It's probably just like a salt craving, which is so good. So we had a phase of watching films like Tampopo and Ishi the Killer. And I think also I first watched Mystics and Valley at that time, but that's, yes, an Indonesian film. But I still like kind of like lump it in with that realm. We were definitely watching also like some Studio Ghibli and Miyazaki works. But yeah, saw House and was like, what on earth did I just watch? It was like no other film I'd seen before. And not only due to the fact that there's this like kind of experimental process or like experimental tool playing through the film, but also in how the sense of time seems to like lull and then rush and then lull again. Like every time I watch it, my sense of time and temporality is really beautifully skewed. And so the few other times I've viewed House, it was often in the context again of visual spectacle, like putting it on at like, I think we did it honestly at like a record night one time. Nice. Like always having it in the time, in the context of like sound off, people are drinking and talking and partying, but it being like a visual display. It was such a treat to have this watch focus more on like cultural context and Obayashi's perspective as an artist. And while the film is so playful and like really has such a buoyant energy, this latest watch honestly felt really heavy. I mean, I was like, I started research before this rewatch and learning about like Obayashi's childhood and the experiences and events around Hiroshima and the atomic bombs. And like, so yeah, it was a very new affect that I was trying to navigate with this most recent watch, which was really interesting. Yeah. What was your history with this film?
This was my first time watching it. So thank you so much for suggesting it. I think I first heard about it, probably like 10 years ago. Everyone, all my music trader pals really, really liked it. So yeah, I heard about it through them. And it's been on my watch list for a long time. And yeah, it was not at all what I was expecting. I'm not really sure like what, I was definitely expecting like more of like a straightforward sort of like horror story, but like, I just thought it found it was like so creative and so like visually striking, and like its connection to fairy tales, dreams and nightmares, and like how it can be read as kind of on a very superficial level, just as like, oh, girls go to a haunted house type movie. And even that's like enjoyable, or even like, yeah, putting it on at a party or in an art space or something like that. But then, yeah, like there's also like so many like very serious like layers to it, and it's able to like say so much while still maintaining this very like playful and like silly quality. Yeah, I also love the set design, obviously, and all the like in-camera tricks and like how it's intentionally fake. Like it's not trying to sell you like reality. Like you do have to sort of like accept this world of the film.
Absolutely. Those shots when there's like the painted set. Yes. And the camera zooms out and it's like, boop, 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 like so clearly this, as you said, intentionally fake or like fictionalized story we're being sold.
Totally. And it definitely reminded me of, what was that movie that we talked about? The anthology movie. Kwaidan.
Yes.
it definitely reminded me of Kwaidan, which is the anthology movie that we covered, a little while ago, And again, like that was also all filmed on different sets and sort of like brought you into this like fantasy realm using sets and costumes and in-camera tricks and all that stuff. And I just think it's like, yeah, so creative.
That's apt. So
interesting. Yeah.
And thinking of that film's like connection to like what I perceived as theater.
Yes.
Or kind of read as theater. Yeah. And then bringing that thread into this is like very rich. Because mm-hmm. What year was that one? That's before this?
Yes, that was before. I believe it was 1960. Let me just check. 1964.
Cool.
And this is 1977. Yeah. And I think, yeah, they both draw on Japanese folktales and fairy tales and stuff, but how they're able to like execute those stories is very different, but also connected in a way.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to start out by talking about the writing and production of House. So following the success of Jaws, the American film, a proposition came from the Japanese film studio Toho for Obayashi to develop a similar script and make a blockbuster horror film. To find inspiration for the story, Obayashi discussed ideas with his preteen daughter, Chigumi, believing that adults only think about things they understand. Everything stays on that boring human level, while children can come up with things that can't be explained. Several of Chigumi's ideas were included in House, such as a reflection in a mirror attacking the viewer, a watermelon being pulled out of a well appearing like a human head, and a house that eats girls. Other themes Chigumi suggested drew upon her own childhood fears. These fears included a pile of futons falling on her that felt like a monster attacking her, a large loud clock at her grandparents' home, and getting her fingers caught in between the piano keys. Obayashi also desired the special effects to look unrealistic, as if a child created them, and wanted the effects to look intentionally fake. So as we mentioned, in the, again, like having that fairy tale element. And yeah, it's just like very interesting to me that studio wanted to make a blockbuster film like Jaws, which is such a literal, straightforward guys on a boat movie, you know? And like House is not at all like that. Just so creative and so imaginative, but also like bananas and nonsensical in a way. And like, I think young audiences apparently really liked the film, but I don't think it did well critically. And I have a quote here from Obayashi with an interview with Criterion Channel. And he says, "I always discuss important matters with children. Adults can only think about things they understand. So everything stays on that boring human level. At that level, a hit movie about shark attacks leads to one about bear attacks. That's the best they can do. But children come up with things that can't be explained. They like the strange and mysterious. The power of cinema isn't in the explainable. It is in the strange and inexplicable."
Yes. This film like breeds that like childlike sense of like time and play and experience in such a strange, and as I said earlier, now I'm just thinking of it in a sad way.
Yeah,
but we'll get to that. Yeah. So when we decided to do this film, I was trying to figure out like how best to navigate research, and I found it really generative to listen to Faculty of Horror, who are Alexandra West and Andrew Sipsati, and their episode on House. And they approached this film in a really open-ended way and analyzed it through a feminist lens, looking at the roles of women culturally in pre-war and post-war Japan. So talking about like marriage and family dynamics, which traditionally operated within quite staunchly patriarchal parameters. And they also set up a really strong framework of how the film addresses intergenerational or transgenerational relations. So we see these examples of lineage in the character of Gorgeous, who's kind of like, I go back and forth. I mean, I don't know if this is even like a relevant thing, but I go back and forth between wondering if like they're the protagonist or if fantasy is the protagonist. The film starts with a photo series of, or not a photo, but a photo shoot of fantasy taking pictures of Gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And their friendship kind of remains at the center, or arguably is like
it a friendship. It's a romance.
Yeah. Honestly, because it bookends, like it completely bookends the film, and it's yes, what you said, absolutely. And anyway, so this, yeah, thinking back to Lee, to the character of Gorgeous, like something that I instantly think about is there's a scene where she's looking in the mirror and transmogrifies into, I believe it's her mother and her aunt. I feel like there's like a temporal kind of shifting there. And then something that the film also touches on is like the void that like the loss in general or generational relationships can cause. So in looking at the scene where Gorgeous is in her deceased mother's room and like speaking to her photo, and it's like this like memory fueled moment that inspires Gorgeous to write to her aunt about staying at her house over the summer. And then we also see the generational frustrations or rifts that can occur quite blatantly through the character of the auntie, who's a ghostly magical figure who gains power by feeding off of unwed or young women. And earlier in the film, we learned that the auntie had a lover who went off to war and never came home. The auntie made a promise to always wait for him in the house. And there's this, so yeah, that's the auntie. And then there's also this really interesting relationship between Gorgeous and her father's new girlfriend, who Gorgeous meets at the beginning of the film. And the film ends with the new girlfriend driving out to the house to visit Gorgeous. And the father's girlfriend has this like soap opera theme song. Everyone kind of has this theme song, and hers is this like beautiful soap opera thing that I can't even describe right now.
She's like very, very glamorous.
Yes, she's so glamorous. And there's like an American quality to it. Like there's something very like, I don't know, glossy and like Miami, or what I perceive to be.
I totally get you what you mean. Yes.
Yeah, because she's always depicted with her scarf and like this like breezy voluminous blouse, and there's always like a wind off screen that we can tell is like creating this, and her presence on the screen also, perhaps this is where I'm getting the Americana from, it always makes me think of Isadora Duncan, who's like the pioneer of white Eurocentric modern dance. When she died, she had this like very, very, very long scarf. She was like a very like flowy fabrics woman. And she died, she was driving, I think she was in France at the time, and her scarf caught in the back tire of a convertible and strangled her. And yeah, there's like a Gertrude Stein quote about affectations can be dangerous, which she said after she died. It's like, oh my gosh, like there's so much about this death that is like fascinating and fucked and dark and loaded. And so I feel like that's maybe where my Americana and like a melancholy kind of
melodrama.
Thank you. That's maybe a. It's funny also that I attribute it to Americana when she was actually in Europe at the time. But I think maybe that's my own mixings of modern dance and modern dance training. Anyways, one of the final scenes also is with this girlfriend with the scarf and Gorgeous sitting across from one another, and Gorgeous is wearing a traditional kimono, and she sits quite rigid and stoic while the girlfriend is also seated, and her garments are like moving and seem to dance. And they both reach out their hands, and as their hands meet, Gorgeous's eyes like flash green and the girlfriend bursts into flame. And these moments in the film really seem to ask questions about like processing trauma and how trauma might impart through generational, I don't know why I keep on missing that word, generational relationships. And it being like perhaps this film, being an exploration of intergenerational trauma. And Gorgeous's sadness leaves her open to influence by her evil auntie, just like how her auntie's sadness and loss has left her in this continual cycle of violent, if not ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous and at times comical like consumption. Anyway, just attempting to wrap up what I'm saying, Alexandria and Andrea, faculty for really like their articulations of it leave it really complex and messy, and don't like force answers on this film that is like, kind of beyond any sort of concrete analyzation. Totally. Which is really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it is such an experimental film in a lot of ways. And I think that like, trying to figure it out or to force answers almost ruins it in a way. And like, I say this like as I'm on my own show analyzing movies, But you just, again, like I said, you just have to like accept the rules of house and let it take you on this journey without trying to force like too literal a meaning on it, especially from a Western lens. That being said, I did find, I think it's like Gorgeous's stepmother, like her father like went away and then married this woman, correct?
Oh, are they married? Or they're, I thought they were like about to get
married. I thought they were married. Anyway, soon to be stepmom or stepmom. That is very, like, felt very much like fairy tale sort of structure, sort of like an evil stepmother, dead or like absent mother, kind of like dopey dad, who's basically like, hi daughter, here's this stranger who's your mom now.
But then also how the dad like really doesn't come into play throughout the rest of the film. Like it's the, what I perceived as the girlfriend, but, or the stepmom that is seeking Gorgeous and is like kind of stepping into like a parental role.
Totally.
So it absolutely. Also,
That what you mentioned about the father kind of made me think that like this film is about almost like ineffectual men or like absent for whatever reason, whether it's, they just can't emotionally be present, or like you think of the teacher character, how he just can't get to the house. He's just kind of this like bumbling fool. And then there's Auntie's lover who was killed. So it is these kind of like, absent men that these girls are sort of like building this fantasy on.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. The bumbling professor or teacher guy who gets turned into bananas.
Yeah. this film also reminds me of our discussion on Eyes Without a Face that we had a few weeks ago, and the relationship between war, myth-making, and memory. But with House, it is the younger generation that is romanticizing the past. And I think this is evident in the scene where Gorgeous is describing her mother and aunt, where her memory of their story is shown as a silent movie. And I think it's important to say that it's like, what we are seeing is Gorgeous is like memory of a story. It's not like,
it's like a child, it's like a child's perspective or perception of this tale.
Yes, exactly.
And also how the friends are commenting. On it as it's playing is like
It's so interesting, like such a like again like such a creative way to show like a flashback, essentially. It's like someone's memory is to show it as a silent movie, and these girls are making several comments about how Auntie's story is so romantic, how her lover is so manly, and even comparing a shot of a mushroom cloud to cotton candy. And this sort of like romanticization and forgetting leads to resentment and bitterness and a greater generational divide between Auntie and the girls. And I do think it's interesting to think of like this curse on this house and on Auntie and the girls kind of like an allegory for intergenerational trauma.
Totally. Yeah. Cause instantly you can, there's like, because of how the film is navigating these generational roles and like differences. And then, it seems like there's like borders or obstacles kind of occurring between, and then in doing more research on the aftermath of Hiroshima, and something that apparently like really hindered grief and trauma processes was the fact that like any media or documentation about Hiroshima was censored or confiscated. And I don't quote me on this because I need to do research better, but I think it was censored until like the 50s or so. And American occupation of Japan resulted in like full control of the narrative within Japan and also obviously elsewhere. Then this would have deeply impacted those navigating the trauma of the event, with the skewed narrative wreaking havoc for all, as well as like, let alone to think of like being a family and trying to explain the situation to children, or like to trying to relate these stories when so much knowledge has been withheld and censored. It's like, of course that causes these blockages and these interceptions between generations. So I'm just thinking so much about Hiroshima watching this film. So I've been doing, I did some more research on Obayashi and the atomic bombs and the Pacific War. And as you all have mentioned earlier, there's like the Criterion Channel has an interview with Obayashi and his daughter Chikumi and the screenwriter Chiho Katsura. And it was so informative. It's so beautiful to watch. And something I'd kind of pieced together from Wikipedia, but then was confirmed by Obayashi, was that he did grow up in Hiroshima. And the fact he had, like, that not many of his childhood friends survived, like a lot of them died due to the atomic bomb dropped by the States. And then I'm totally sideboarding right now to World War II and the Pacific War for a sec. So this, I feel so ignorant. Like, as a kid, probably due to like the god awful Pearl Harbor film, which, disclaimer, as a preteen, I loved, like Josh Hartnett. Yes,
it's like sexy propaganda. Like,
thank you. Yes, exactly. Like, yes. And like, so like that kind of thing, like Hollywood propaganda, American propaganda, there, like, I had this idea of Hiroshima being the end of World War II and like it being tied up in these like tit for tat, such like that's how war is kind of situations. Yeah. And then, so that had been kind of my own like personal messy timeline of it. And then it's also like, it's complicated. So yeah, I grew up like, you know, with these like very pacifist dialogues. Mm-hmm. And I like, you know, in communities that are like anti-nationalist and anti-military do absurd degrees. And I do want to just like stress the conflation of these events, of these events in so much American-centric media, which is incredibly frustrating. And obviously not like your knowledge to so many people. But for me, I was like, as I was doing research. Anyway, so delving more deeply into Pacific War or wars, it was like so many little things. Anyway, I'm not sure how best to articulate the breakage of time, but the horrifying messiness of it all is like Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these two events that are so cruel and hard to wrap my head around. Mm-hmm. And something that I ended up coming back to in this research was as a kid reading 1000 Paper Cranes, which is just really beautiful and heartbreaking. Oh, yeah. It's like a children's book. Yeah. And I was like, bro, I reread that book when I was doing this and helped like to understand like the weight of these things. And then as a teenager, there's this book called The Brothers K. It's by David James Duncan. And it's a take of sorts on the brothers Karamazov, which is, I think it's like Tolstoy. It's like Russian lit nonsense. but this version, like it navigates like American zeitgeists in these war times, and it brought me to like this like darker effective place of understanding the Pacific War and the brutality of like nuclear weapons and the effects of them. So yeah, anyways, Obayashi, the director of House, was 7 or so when the bombs were dropped, and in the interview he speaks to how being from that place and being affected by the bomb, having his childhood friends die, this naturally became a theme in the film. And one moment in his interview that really stuck out was him talking about how those born after the war are unaware of how precious peace is. And this really like hit hard and like puts into context for me, like, so the end of the film, I guess specifically the whole film, but in the end of the film, the text speaks about the importance of telling stories of love, the importance of love. And I can't remember the exact wording, but it's an offering or an invitation to the viewer to like cherish and hold on to stories of love and peace, and that's really critical. And then there's a few clear moments of like Hiroshima references in House. So as you mentioned, there's the like child's perspective, the image of the atom bomb cloud looking like cotton candy, and then there's often sounds of a loud airplane overhead. And next watch, I like noted it in my reading, but I need to pay better attention to when they happen and who hears them, because I remember them like pockmarking
the film. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, there's like airplane sounds that every once in a while come in, and I can't recall, I don't have in my notes where I was hearing them, but they're there, and I am so curious, because yeah, it's like this like kind of like stressful, like aggressive and militant sound, but I can't remember the context. So that's something that I look forward to doing further research on. And then there's also that scene where Gorgeous looks in the mirror. There's the transmogrification suffocation situation. Mm-hmm. But then she also disintegrates into flames and her body is like consumed by flames. Mm-hmm. And then also whenever the girls pick up the phone, there's a couple times they like try to call for help. And then there's disembodied voices of people calling out for mm-hmm. help on the line, which was just like so chilling.
Yeah.
And then each time a girl is killed or consumed by the house, they're stripped seemingly. Mm-hmm. Like their clothing is often found, but their body is missing. Just kind of like a, yeah. In the scene where Prof falls into the bloody flood, mm-hmm. bloody flood, whatever, waters
yeah,
rise.
A room is filling up with this like bloody, yeah, bloody water. And
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Obayashi had, I guess when they were creating it, Obayashi had blue paint poured on the actor's naked body from above. Mm-hmm. So you have the effect of her disintegrating. And watching this scene instantly makes me think of, there's that like infamous photo of the girl running through the eviscerated streets of Hiroshima yes. after her clothing was burnt off, and seeing this actor's body. Yeah, it's just like, oh my gosh, like that is that photo. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder about Obayashi's desire to write a fantasy about the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. He speaks multiple times in that interview about it being a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really stuck on that scene where fantasy is the last girl not consumed by the house. Mm-hmm. And she's like clinging to this raft of mm-hmm. sorts, kind of floating on top of the blood. And Gorgeous, who at that time is kind of shifting back and forth between her aunt, mm-hmm. kind of rescues her and holds her close in this motherly protection-like way before her eyes flash green. And mm-hmm. which is the sign of that cursed witch ghost cat. Blanche.
Yeah.
And then, but fantasy is also the one who sees all the deaths mm-hmm. and is also the one who is trying to record or capture the events. Mm-hmm. She's the one taking pictures of Gorgeous in the beginning and attempts to take a picture of the auntie before the auntie magically destroys her camera. Mm-hmm. So fantasy could be seen as the role of the artist, like mm-hmm. seeing and recording and sharing what's happening despite silence and censorship, which we know was a big problem with Hiroshima and the aftermath mm-hmm. of it. So it has me thinking about the importance of fantasy in order to reimagine and recreate. And this is something that echoes through Yoko Ono's work, who's an artist also who's impacted by the atomic bombs. And I feel as though Obayashi and Ono use their work and their forms as this like invitation to recreate mm-hmm. or re-experience, and the necessity of like radical reimagining for social and political change. I actually feel like my note here is like grapefruit.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, so Yoko Ono has this book called Grapefruit, and it's so beautiful, and I read about like a page or two a day, and it's just like scores mm-hmm. for living. Like one of the scores is like listen to a heart beat, and there's ones about like screaming into the wind, and like it's the most beautiful text, and it's childlike, but it's also like really effective and dark and like embodied. And so just in thinking of Obayashi's and Ono's work, both kind of coming from the same time and place, it's mm-hmm. like, yeah, I don't know, I don't have the words for the resonances, but it's something yeah, they both harness like a childlike sense to their work. And as you mentioned earlier, like House is co-created with Obayashi's daughter and gained much of its initial viewership through young youth populations. And it makes me think of how, like, yeah, when things feel really devastating or dark, like to think of like young kids and youth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so cheesy. But like thinking like that is like tapping into that is like survival. Like yeah. It is survival.
Mm-hmm.
And as Obayashi says, there's like this desire to understand or to put into words and to articulate clearly and foolproofly with adults as like I experience constantly. And like that gets in the way of exploration and creation. And so then to think of this film being something that like is trying to like get around that like desire to understand and to like pinpoint and articulate clearly, it being this just like effective, emotional, like explosion for like lack of a better word
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to think that like I don't know, it's
so there's a lot, it's about a lot, it's very
yes
it's fascinating for something that could be like read on a very like superficial level and still be like a fun movie. Mm-hmm. Right. And it is interesting to think of, like you mentioned, the propaganda and like how maybe younger generations didn't understand how precious peace could be. And like, I like to think of this project, or it's interesting to think of this project as like Obayashi of an older generation, sort of like creating this narrative with his younger generation, so that with his daughter, so that she could understand, or that younger people could understand.
My heart. God, yes. Honestly, because the ending, it's so like sometimes I watch it and I'm like, what is this hippie nonsense? Like, yeah. The ending is so like peace and love, and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But like what you just said, yes, this fact that it could be like a thread. Oh, because what's that quote? His daughter says something about that too, of like, for their relationship, that film was like, that's how they, father and daughter connected. Yes. And sort of, as you said, this film being like the way that they were able to like communicate and connect is like, my heart is like melting.
Oh no, we're being vulnerable on the show again.
God damn it.
You already made me cry today. This is my revenge.
Oh, God damn.
Characters in a bit more detail. So I have a quote here from an essay by Kate Hagen from theblacklist.com. So Gorgeous's squad, that is not my word, squad of seven beautiful besties includes athletic Kung Fu, who's my favorite. I love Kung Fu.
As an Aries, I relate to
Kung Fu. Yes.
I love Kung Fu.
Hyper-intelligent prof, the inexplicably reasonable fantasy, talented melody, the very hungry Mac, and the diminutive sweet. The women of House adhere to their stereotyped roles throughout the film, but as the meta elements of the film's construction suggest, House is also commenting on the roles we assign to women in horror, the slut, the virgin, the busybody, etc. By making these stereotypes an essential part of House's story, the film is able to provide a comedic commentary on how women transmute identities based on the situation they're in.
Okay, hang in. We meet again. I'm critiqued.
Yes, I know. I would feel bad because we dunked on her last week too.
I'm sorry. I know. I'm an ass.
I Kate like Hagen,
I'm sorry. I know. I'm being like critical.
Writing. Yeah. So yeah, not to dunk on Kate Hagen again, but
no, sorry, Kate Hagen.
But I read a few essays on how gender is portrayed in the film, and like there are like two sides that I found, or like two themes, where it's like some writers state that the portrayals are empowering and others see the roles as very stereotypical and exploitative. And I didn't realize the film was so divisive. I didn't feel that strongly about it. And it's like, it's hard not to look at the film through a Western lens. So I'm not really sure where I stand or what Obayashi's intentions were with the characterizations. So yeah, I'm just curious as to what you think of how the gender roles are portrayed in the film.
Good. Question. Yes. And I agree. Like, I can see how the film is divisive. It's also kind of surprising that this like chaotic masterpiece is like a divisive gender thing, which is kind of funny to me. But then, yeah, the fact that like we can't not view this film through our Western lens is like imperative. Yeah, so sorry, Kate. I thought your theories were a bit reductive when we discussed Eyes of the Face. And I still think they're a bit reductive. And I'm going to try to be not such a poo-poo head. I may be always being hyperbolic. I also just thinking of, I don't know, now my editor brain is on and like their use of we is like epistemological violence, Kate Hagen. Like, who is the we? It's Western, like, anyway. So in going back to his interview, Obayashi talks about like the magic of 7-member teams, which it's like, yeah, I like from being like in stage productions where it's like, yeah, you want like 3 people, you want 5 people, you want 7 people, like you want odd numbers. It's like, there's a beauty in that number.
Yeah. I feel like that's also like an element of design too.
Yes.
Whether it's totally. Like interior design or graphic design, it always just kind of, it's like visually pleasing.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And like, even thinking of like all of the, I mean, we'll get into this a little bit, but like, I'll get into it now. So the film was like so Obayashi like wrote the script and then they were the production house, I can't remember the name. Was like, trying to find like a director for it. Mm-hmm. And Obayashi just ended up like marketing the film for like 2 whole years. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's all these like promo pictures of him and the leads in these photos. And it's like these beautiful, like nice compositions because of the 7. Anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then to tie it back into Hiroshima, Obayashi also references the fact that there would be teams of 7 sent out to extinguish fires following bombings by the US Army. And then, yes, so my partner, who knows way more about Japanese culture than I do, they tattoo in Japanese styles and tattooing and whatever, has lots of, yeah, you have to know a lot of the roots to these imagery and these myths and legends and all of these things. So he was talking about like likening this team of girls to like idol culture in Japan. Mm. So similar to like Spice Girls, idols are like these manufactured characters constructed for their relatability for young audiences and obviously for consumption. Yeah. Because we are living capitalism. So singing contest. There was a singing contest show, Star Tanjo! Which was in the 70s. So that seems to be like kind of one of the roots for idol infatuation. So that show also very much, I'm sure there's essays written on this, but I think mm-hmm. that like spawned like American mm-hmm. Idol and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there was also the Johnnies in the 60s or one of like the first idol groups. And they were like a boy band, like full yeah. on boy band. So yes, to answer your question, I feel so Obayashi's intention with these characters might be like, they seem like a nod to idol culture, which is becoming very popular in the 70s. The film was made in 77, but we know it was in production years before that. Mm-hmm. And it also like, yeah, very well might be a nod to the simplified one-dimensional characters that one sees in like blockbuster films, mm-hmm. whether they be Japanese, American, or otherwise. So we also know, like learn, or in thinking of that interview, learned that Obayashi did a lot of like commercials. Like that mm-hmm. was his career, was mm-hmm. making commercials. And I mean, he had some like younger early days, an experimental film. But yeah, he was like paying rent, making commercials. And so it could be him taking the piss out of superficial depictions of people through commercial marketing campaigns, like female gendered or otherwise. And sorry, Hagen. I do think it's North American centric to assume that these roles in house adhere to like gendered stereotypes found in Hollywood films and slashers and blockbusters of the 70s. I mean, if anything, like, I mean, I'm talking here about the element of transmutation being like totally temporally fluctuating with like Gorgeous containing multitudes or Aunt and her mom. And like, yeah. I tend to view these like stereotyped roles, I'm using air quotes, mm-hmm. as elements of a whole. So in knowing that his daughter had a huge role in creating the film. Mm-hmm. And I mean, part of me is like, well, yeah, like they're all her. Mm-hmm. Like she was afraid of being smothered by this mattress monster. And like Sweet was, that was the character's mother. She was, and she created like that beautiful scene of Melody's piano consumption through her own memories of piano lessons and having obviously like probably a really aggressive teacher. And then yeah, like she's Mac in the moment of placing a watermelon in a deep well and like letting it chill and imagining what's going to be reeled in from that. And I think the characters are like this continuation of a childlike play, figuring out selfhood and identity. And yeah, I just like feel like it's like these multitudes of a whole. And so I totally understand like the complexities of like wanting to pinpoint whether it's like dichotomous as like exploitative or empowering. Mm-hmm. But like in thinking of like when the film was made, and I think your tack on like fairy tale structures is mm-hmm. apt, is completely apt. And I think, yeah, that like, it's like that, and it's this fascinating combination of like this commercial realm happening in Japan in the 70s that like is able to play with like that binary thinking mm-hmm. in being like multitudinous, and also obviously like very much a comment on like, yeah, how like capitalism has us be like, what's your identity, and mm-hmm. it be like a two-dimensional or like feeling like it's a non-shifting thing. Mm-hmm. But again, I keep on returning to the daughter and like feel like it's like a childhood exploration of self. Mm-hmm. Makes me the most excited and happy.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And like the characters reminded me of simplified characterization or two-dimensional characterization. We see a lot in children's media with each character having like one superficial defining element of their character. And I think this helps with audience identification and like you said, figuring out selfhood. So in a house, we see each girl has a superficial aspect of the personality. Prof is smart and acts as the detective. Sweet enjoys cleaning and being helpful. Kung Fu is brave and can fight. Melody plays the piano. And the host of Faculty Forward made the interesting point that the young girls probably have more options than Auntie and the older pre-war generation of women. And maybe that's where the resentment comes from. And I think the house ultimately consumes each girl by exploiting their own specific personality trait. And yeah, while it can be North American centric to relate roles to tropes or Hollywood films, I do think the film uses, like you said, yeah, certain fairy tale and horror tropes. Also, it's interesting to think of like how this film was influenced by Jaws. So there is influence happening between film industries at the same time. I don't think it's necessarily like too North American centric to sort of see these themes in this film because all these films are influencing each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And you're right. Like, I don't understand the Jaws connection. Like, I know it's influenced. Yeah. I know it's there.
Yeah.
I know it's there, but I'm just like, what?
I guess because Steven Spielberg at the time was kind of like a smaller, like a lesser known filmmaker. And he was able to make this like enormous blockbuster that is like kind of a simple story.
Right.
And so the Japanese production system wanted to sort of like capitalize on an interest in sort of like simple horror films. That's what I sort of like gathered from my research.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yes. And just sort of to go back to the fairy tale and horror trope. So we see the young people staying in an old house, one-dimensional characters, the creepy harbinger that the girls meet on their way to Auntie's house. These are all classic plot points that we see in contemporary North American films. So yeah, house is very formative while winking at classic fairy tales and horror tropes.
Yes, I agree with that. And like, yeah, I feel like Obayashi also like brought up like Alice in Wonderland in that in that little interview too. And it's like, yeah, like it's like a children's story. And thinking of like, yeah, these classic fairy tales, it is like, what are like this as a vehicle for like telling a story about like intergenerational like loss or like reconnection.
Yeah.
To be hopeful. Is really like quite a beautiful vehicle for that kind of theme.
Yeah, I totally agree. So yeah, that's our show this week. Thank you so much for joining us.
And Jill, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming back. This is really great. I'm glad we were finally able to talk about this movie.
Me too. Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, it's a film that's always been kind of, visual or feeling almost like superficial level, and so that the chance to delve into like the nitty gritty of it was beautiful. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. And I just want to remind everyone about my programming that's going to be coming up at Cinematheque and Cinematheque at Home. I'm going to have some live shows and Q&As and discussions and all that. So please follow Winnipeg Cinematheque on Instagram and Facebook and all those things. And yeah, I'll be talking about the programming on the show more. So
yay.
Yeah, thanks. And you can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. And I'll be recording new episodes every 2 weeks. You can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Bikini Drive-In. Jill, look, where can people find you in your work?
At Jill Groening, JILLGROENING, on Twitter and Instagram. Don't you dare find me on Facebook because I don't use it. And I haven't deleted it yet. So it's not updated. So don't you dare go there.
No.
I also have a website, but that also needs to be updated. So don't go there either.
What's your website?
JillianGroening.com.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks so much. Together and alive to be waiting with you.
powered by volunteer community involvement. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.